So, welcome, dear viewers. It's a great pleasure and a great honor for me to connect you today with Kieran Krishan. Thank you very much, Kieran, for joining us today. It's really wonderful to have met you. And it was a virtual communication by a video I saw of you, and I said, "Well, I have to get that man for our summit." So here he is. Thank you very much, Jan.
My pleasure. Yeah, thank you.
So the subject today is going to be about those microorganisms that live on us and in us, mostly about what's in us. And there's so much talk about the immune system. And I mean, we're hitting autumn now, so immune system is going to be a big topic, especially in our times at the moment. Most people have heard that the gut has something to do with our immune system, but not too many are really sure what it means. What's your opinion about that? What does the gut have to do with our immune system?
Yeah, that is so important to understand, right? So the normal saying that people hear is 70 to 80% of your immune system is in your gut. And that sounds, you know, pretty alarming when you think about it, but what does it actually mean and how is your immune system in your gut? That's really the key, right? So, it's important to note for the viewers, the listeners, that the immune system is made up of certain parts that are important for development and function of the eventual immune cells themselves. So you've got the areas from which the immune cells come originally, right? You've got areas like the bone marrow and the thymus that actually make the immune cells. But once they're made, they have to go to certain local areas where they mature and start learning about the world around them, right? So the immune cells don't start off with a map of what the world looks like. They have to learn what the world looks like through interaction with the outside environment. And so once they're made in the bone marrow and the thymus, they go to areas like the lymph nodes where they get activated and mature, and they start to understand what is friend and what is foe, what needs to be attacked and what shouldn't be attacked, right? And that shouldn't be attacked part is equally important and in some cases more important than what should be attacked, right? Because if your immune system goes haywire and attacks everything it sees, then you're going to be developing a whole host of other complications. So speaking of that, then one of the largest networks of lymph nodes where the immune cells, once they're made, they go to mature and they go to get trained is in the mesenteric lymphatic system. So the mesenteric lymph nodes have this amazing network, and from there the immune cells can go to almost any part of the body. And the mesenteric lymph nodes are connected directly to the digestive tract. Right. And the reason they're connected to the digestive tract is because our largest exposure to the world around us comes through the digestive tract, right? Everything we eat, we breathe, we drink all ends up somehow in the digestive tract. So even if we think about breathing in air, right? So everything goes into the nose or into the mouth. And then, of course, in the lungs, and any particulate matter gets caught up with the mucus. And then through the mucociliary elevator, all that stuff is lifted up and you end up swallowing it. So, you know, even the eyes, the ears, everything drains into the back of the throat. And then you end up swallowing it, right? So we're sampling the world around us by ingesting the world around us. And when we ingest the world around us, the immune system needs to know what all is coming in, because that's indicative of what's around us. The immune cells aren't outside the body to study the environment. They're inside the body and they're waiting for the biggest sampling that's coming in. And as it happens, inside the digestive tract, we have the largest sampling tissues of the immune system, the entire mucus associated lymphoid tissue. That's the MALT, and then the gut associated lymphoid tissue, and then very specific areas like the Peyer's patches are all these areas of sampling that the immune system works with. So that's really what we mean when we say the majority of your digestive tract is in your immune is in your gut, because somewhere around 70% of all of the sampling tissue, the tissue that the immune system uses to sample the world around you, is found in your digestive tract. And the immune system predominantly learns about the world around you through the digestive tract.
I mean, that's you brought up an interesting aspect that our most surface in contact with our environment out there. I was researching in the last few months the interaction between the microbiome in the lungs and in the gut, and I was amazed to see there's huge interaction. And if the lung microbiome is not so good, the gut and vice versa. Can you just it just sprung to my mind when you said that? Can you say something about that?
You know, this is a super fascinating area, and this actually brings up areas of this of science that we don't even understand that well just yet, right? Because the microbial world and how the microbes even within the body communicate, there's some aspects of it that are still a bit of a mystery. What seems to be clear in the process of a lung infection, for example, whether it's influenza or the pandemic virus, what tends to happen is the first cells that notice an infection is going on are the microbes that live in the lungs, right? And the microbes that live in the lungs realize that there's some disruption to the ecosystem. There's an invading virus that's come in and that's starting to kill our lung cells, our epithelial cells. And so the microbes in that area start to recognize that, and they want to send signals to attract the immune system to that site of action. The interesting thing, and it's not really a problem, but the interesting thing is that the microbes in the lungs send that communication to the microbes in the gut. And then it's the microbes in the gut that activate the immune cells through the mesenteric lymph nodes, which I mentioned earlier, where the mesenteric lymph nodes are directly connected to the gut. So that's one of the most expansive networks of lymphatic tissue and nodes where the cells mature. So the signals then go from the gut to the mesenteric lymph nodes, and then the immune cells are recruited to the lungs. So the microbes in the lungs send a signal to the microbes in the gut. The microbes in the gut alert the immune system and go, hey, you got to get to the lungs because there's a problem going on over there. And then the immune cells finally get themselves to the lungs. So there's this gut-lung axis that we talk about. There's a gut-skin axis, the gut-brain axis, the gut-liver axis, there's everything, right? And all of these axes that we're coming to find out, and in large part, a really core component of these axes is that microbes in these different regions of the body can communicate with each other. And the microbes in these areas, like in the skin and so on, can inform the microbes in the gut what's happening in that local region. And it helps the microbes in the gut, who play a huge role in training the immune system, to recruit those immune cells to the site of action.
I mean, it just brought up another interesting aspect, and that is our knowledge at the moment is still quite limited. In fact, it makes me very humble looking at that. What do you think? How vast is our understanding of the entire microbiome at our current stage in our time?
We're at just the very tip of the iceberg, right? And even just that tip has revealed probably 100-fold more about how we function than the previous 100 years of research combined, right? So, I mean, it wasn't until the NIH kicked off the Global Microbiome Project that we really started to understand what is the root cause of most disease, how diseases progress, why are individuals different in terms of their response to food, to medications, to the environment, all of these things, right? And then also the simple question of how do we have the capabilities that we have, even though we don't have the genetic the material to do all of the functions that we do, right? So I remember I was still in school when the Human Genome Project was going on, and part of the human genome research was actually in one of the biochemistry labs at my university, which was super exciting to be around. And you know, there was a prediction early on before the Human Genome Project actually sequenced the entire human genome. The prediction was that we would have somewhere around 130,000 to 150,000 functional genes, right? Because we're very complex organisms. We have lots and lots and lots of metabolic functions and chemical reactions and proteins we make. And so that was the estimation. But then as they went through and refined the human genome, what we found was that most of the genetic material in the human genome is just nonsense sequences that mean nothing. And when you really look at the effective number of genes, it's somewhere around 22,000, right? And so then that became a huge mystery. Like, wait a minute, if we only have 22,000 genes, how are we doing everything that we do? Right. And you compare that to something like an earthworm that has almost 30,000 genes, functional genes, or a plant like a rice plant that has 35 to 40,000 functional genes, right? We are less sophisticated biologically than an earthworm or a rice plant is, right? And it just blows your mind to go, how did we move up the evolutionary ladder and the right? And the food chain. And the way we did is because we have 2 to 3 million microbial genes in our system, right? Most of our function comes from microbial DNA, not even human DNA. And so when you start to wrap your head around that idea that most of being human is derived from microbes, then until we start studying the microbes, we really don't understand the human condition, right? And we're just now tapping into that. So it's a very, very exciting time. We're finally revealing some really cool connections, on things that were a mystery to science for some time, but it also is giving us the pathway to simple discoveries that can make a huge impact on our health outcomes.
Well, it seems kind of anachronistic that in the human genome project, we had to reduce numbers, and it seems like in the human microbiome project, we have to increase it daily.
Right.
So, talking about quantity, because you often talk about the importance of diversity and how that has shrunk. Can you tell us a little bit why it has shrunk and why it is so important to have diversity?
Absolutely. And in fact, that's the one of the things that keeps me up at night, right? So as a microbiologist in this world of human health, that's a scary, scary proposition. And just to put it into perspective for people, we just talked about how the vast majority of human functionality comes from the microbes that live in and on our system, right? So they house the genetic material, the predominant genetic material to be human. And we are supposed to house them. And what we're supposed to do is pass them on to the next generation so that our next generation has all of those capabilities as well, all the metabolic, biochemical, immunological capabilities as well. But what is happening is we're facing a mass extinction of critical organisms within the human microbiome, right? And that is pretty evident when you study tribes like the Papua New Guinea hunter-gatherer tribes or the Hadza hunter-gatherer foraging tribes, what you tend to see in those tribes that live how we lived and how our ancestors lived just a few hundred years ago and maybe 1,000 years ago, what you see is that they have double the diversity than the people within the modern world, right? So in some point in the last 100 or so years, we've lost about half the organisms that we should have within our system. And we do a lot of microbiome testing. We've done over 5,000 individuals so far and looking at the microbiome composition. And what we're seeing is in the developed world, and it's certainly in North America, as it is in Europe and other areas, the level of diversity in the individual's microbiome is going down further and further. And what that means is we are not only losing capabilities, we're losing functionality, we're also passing on fewer and fewer organisms to the next generation. To put that in perspective for people, why that's so important, it would be the same, it would be analogous as me saying, and because of our actions today, the next generation is going to be born without a spleen. Right. And then the next generation after that is going to be born without a spleen and without half its liver. You know, it'd be like losing organs because we're losing functionality. And we see that. So when you look at the microbiome of the Papua New Guinea tribes, you find keystone species within those individuals that are widely present in all of the individuals that you test at very high levels. And when you start elucidating what these keystone species do, you find that a lot of them are anti-inflammatory organisms. They bring down and curb inflammatory responses. Some of them that we're working with are organisms that manage stress reduction and work on the gut-brain axis and reduce cortisol and epinephrine levels. They bring down systemic inflammation. They increase cognitive function. You know, all of these things that are clearly important for survival and all of these things that we suffer from today, right, that we band-aid on with medications, right? If we have depression because of something wrong with the gut, we're going to take medication to try to help it, right? If we have slowed down in cognitive function, we're going to try to take nootropics and things like that to try to upregulate cognitive function. When the big issue is the root cause of it, the loss of key microbes that maintain that function for us, that's really what's driving the problem. So in all of the years of microbiome research, so in the last 5 years alone, there's been over 50,000 publications, right, which is just mind-boggling when you think about that level of science, you know, somewhere around 10,000 publications a year. So we're really digging into this pretty deep. What seems to be pretty evident across the board is gut diversity is paramount to health and wellness. Gut diversity dictates immunological function, hormone balance, metabolic and digestive health, even aging. There's lots of studies that show that the diversity in your microbiome will dictate how long you live and what your health condition is going to be throughout your life, right? Because again, when you have diversity, you have more functionality, you have more capability, you have the ability to detox, produce all these compounds, turn over cells better, stimulate the immune system in a more profound way, reduce inflammation in a more profound way, you know, manage stress, all of these things that have a health impact, we lose when we lose diversity. You know, and then the big question you ask about how are we losing diversity? Well, there's a few different things. I think number one, of course, we are a microbial construct, right? We just talked about how we are predominantly microbial, meaning most of the cells in the body are microbes. Most of our DNA in the body is microbes. The microbes within different parts of our body communicate and work with each other to help the host. And the microbiome and the immune system, which I'm sure we'll talk about more, are so intimately connected that the immune system cannot function without the microbiome. So we are microbial in nature, and we've taken this microbial construct that's been kind of perfected by evolution over a long period of time, and we've put it in an antimicrobial world, right? So the world we live in is an anti-human world. It's not conducive to our structure. You know, just think about even our drinking waters, at least in the States, is full of chlorine and fluoride. These are all antimicrobial compounds, right? We, of course, treat water with lots of antimicrobial compounds, so we're drinking that all the time. It's killing off organisms. Most of the packaged foods you eat have antimicrobials, antifungals, bacteriostatics in it. Most of the produce that we eat are covered in pesticides, herbicides that are all antimicrobial in nature. Even the CDC estimates that about 50% of antibiotic prescriptions are unnecessary. So we are certainly over-prescribing antibiotics. And we know clearly that even a single course of antibiotics can disrupt your microbiome significantly for over 2 years, right? And we also know that a single course of antibiotics not only will disrupt your microbiome, but it'll disrupt the microbiome of those living in your same household, even if they don't take the antibiotic. Right? It's insane. We have this microbiome cloud that we travel with and we exchange with one another. We also know that reduction in diversity in your diet has a huge impact on the diversity of your microbiome, right? So our ancestors ate somewhere around 600 different types of foods annually. You know, they foraged, they hunted, they gathered, they did all these things. And we in the Western world maybe eat 15 to 20 different types of foods. So we're not getting much diversity within our diet itself. And another big, big part is we're not engaged with nature anymore, right? We are designed, we are a product of nature. We are a product of soil and earth and dirt. That's where we come from, right? Our cells are bacteria inside every one of our cells, right? We've got the mitochondria, which is essentially an ancient pleiotropic bacteria inside each of our cells. It's basically the human cell is made up of microbes that came together and formed the human cell. And so we are very much connected evolutionarily to the environment, but we've divorced ourselves from the environment because we live in relatively sterile homes and offices and cars and so on. So that lack of exposure also has a huge impact on the microbiome. And if we have time, we should talk about the Finnish allergy study, which is like mind-blowing and awesome, right? It really speaks to this whole issue.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, go ahead, because I found that study. I listened to you talking about that in one of your interviews. I found that amazing. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, that is mind blowing because, and I love that they've invested to do this work because, you know, in Finland and a lot of the modern countries like the US as well, asthma and allergies in kids are just going through the roof, right? It's becoming a pandemic or epidemic of its own. In the US, I know we have over 10 million kids with asthma. And the numbers just keep increasing. So the big question in Finland was, why are our kids developing such bad asthma and allergies and so on? Why is it that every school can't have peanut cookies? And, you know, because there's always at least one kid that's severely anaphylactic to it. And then what's interesting about Finland and is geographically it's in proximity to part of Russia. And there's a town in Russia that is relatively close to a border town in Finland. And that town in Russia actually has much lower rates of allergies and asthma and all that. So even though they're geographically the same, the big question was, why is there a difference between the rates of allergies and asthma? And as they, the government of Finland initiated the study called the Finnish Allergy Study, and they dug into it and they basically figured out in short that it was the level of exposure in these two geographies, right? So in the Russian town, they didn't sterilize their homes as much. They left the doors and windows open more. And so they got a lot more exposure to outside microbes compared to Finland, where things were more closed, more air conditioning, more indoor circulating air, and then a lot more sterilization on surfaces and all that. So that became what was likely the driver of the immune dysfunctions in the kids seen in Finland. Then what's exciting about that is they decided to do something about it. So what they did is they took a certain number of daycare centers throughout the country, and they implemented that these daycare centers would have dirt pits, basically, right? Almost like little garden dirt pits, and the kids would have to play in them for a certain amount of time each week. And as it turns out, then after follow-up in a few years, the daycare centers with the kids playing in the dirt had started developing less allergies and asthma and all that compared to the kids that didn't play in the dirt. You know, so simple, so basic, right? And yet the complexity of the science is really amazing and elegant, but it just speaks to just going back to the basics, how we've evolved for the last several million years and how we are straying away from that construct, the way we're made. And just going back to some of the basics can be so powerful for our overall health and wellness.
Well, that's one of the subjects of the summit, actually, that the solutions are there and they're extremely simple. And it just reminds me, when I treat children in kindergarten age, one of the first questions is, how much time do they spend in nature? And you can literally, with the amount of time they do spend outside, predict how the immune system will be in the winter. I find that really, really amazing. Yeah? But what I find amazing as well, I mean, you talked about the time span that we've invested in all this knowledge. You talked about the amount of knowledge we have accumulated. Now, what I'm always struck with is that it hasn't entered any part of medicine yet. I'm talking about even gastroenterology. I mean, you're talking about psychiatry, neurology. You're talking about anything. But whenever you encounter in the medical system a discipline, you're a quack. You start talking about the microbiome. How come?
Right. Yeah, you know, and there's this, and one of the goals of my company, Microbiome Labs, is to do what I call bridging that translational gap, right? So what exists in the medicine and research world is this massive gap between research and clinic practice, right? So there's a lot that happens in the research world that never or very, very slowly translates to the clinical world, right? And the reason for that is because in the clinical world, the research has to translate via product. And unless the product is created and marketed and promoted, the clinicians almost never know about this research over here, right? Because the clinicians, you know, in their defense, have no time to be going out there and spending time reading random papers and, you know, attending all these conferences. They're seeing patients all day and they're trying to deal with it. There are some clinicians who have the capability, like yourself, to educate yourself beyond what products and toolboxes you have for the clinical practice. So bridging that translational gap, bringing what is being realized in research to using it somehow in practice is kind of a goal of our company. And that gap is so big and so vast, and in most cases never gets filled with anything. And when you look at researchers at university, their focus is on continuously doing research, right? So they go deeper and deeper and deeper into one particular mechanism or protein or gene or whatever they're working on. And their motivation is not to translate that to product, right? And the clinician's motivation is to work on his or her patient. It's not to go and dig into the research and figure out what else can I do. So there's that gap in between. And normally in allopathic medicine, that gap is filled by pharmaceutical companies, right? They might realize something in research, and if it has market value, it'll translate to a product. But again, it has to be patentable. It has to be a big enough issue. It has to be marketable in the right jurisdictions and blah, blah, blah. There's so many other factors that go into whether this research becomes a product for this doctor to use. And so really where we play a role in this world of natural medicine, holistic approach, integrative health is what we are doing and what we should continue to do is bridge that gap to a certain degree, because there's a lot that we've learned from the research that we can very easily translate to behavioral changes that the doctors can push to their patients, right? It's going to take a while to get to the normal gastroenterologists and pediatricians and neurologists, because they're so trained to work within silos, right? And to them, to a gastroenterologist, the gut is not connected to anything else, right? To a neurologist, the neuronal system is not connected to anything else, right? To the brain is separate all by itself. It's working in silos, and they're not trained in any way at all to look at the body as a whole. But it becomes our job, I think, in two parts. One is to start seeding this information to doctors, because what I'm finding the more I speak out there is that doctors are realizing that their outcomes are really poor for their patients, right? Especially with chronic disease management, right? For diabetes and heart disease and Alzheimer's and all of these chronic illnesses, the outcomes are terrible with the current tools. So what else can we do to help with the patients? Because primarily the job is to help the patient. Number two, I think, and this is to me one of the most important parts of what you're doing and inviting me to be part of this, is to empower people. Because what people have to understand right now is they have a lot more power to control their health outcomes than they thought. Right? Because we used to think of disease as something that's bad luck. Oh, you got bad luck, you've got diabetes, right? Oh, you got bad luck, you've got this autoimmune condition. It's just a gene mutation or something like that, right? But no, it's a product of your environment. It's a product of your choices. And the best part about all of this is it's so much of it is reversible. So much of it can be slowed down or reversed or completely abolished. Right? And you have that power within yourselves by simple, small choices that you make every single day. All of it adds up to a huge, profound effect. So the doctors are going to be a long time. You know, it's going to be 10 years from now before gastroenterologists really understand the microbiome. But humans, regular consumers, can affect their microbiome tomorrow by the choices they make and really change their health outcome.
Well, that's very important. I thank you very much for trying to establish that bridge, because I think it's overdue. And I try to do research as well. And trying to translate that into modern practice was just impossible. It was a very frustrating job.
Yeah.
you know that, but that's why we're doing this summit, empowering people. Yeah. It's simple. We don't have to buy mud in the pharmacy. No. Maybe we can patent it and sell it for a huge price, but it's all for free. Yeah. And yep. That's empowering. I like that. And I think you're doing a wonderful job by doing both things at the same time, because I think, as you said, many doctors are quite frustrated. They are actually open. They don't have the time. They never hear about it.
Right.
And so how to get to them is a key for the future to speed up that process, which I think is overdue. But but talking about the microbiome, coming back to that, it's not just bacteria, as many people think. There are many, many other things in it. And one of those things are viruses. And especially in our times, viruses are bad. We had the time where bacteria were bad, and now we recognize, 95% are actually very good for us. But what do you think? How bad is a virus, and how good can a virus be?
Viruses are, as a microbiologist, to me, there were two things that really capture your imagination, right? When you start studying the microbial world, one is viruses and the other is prions. But let's talk about viruses. So viruses are so interesting because they're not a living creature, right? They're not alive, but they are a floating bag of genetic material. And to think about a virus in a villainous way, right, that it has motivation or intent and all that is actually incorrect. It's just there, right? And it's just a happenstance of evolutionary biology and cell biology and nature. These things are just created out of just sheer, happenstance. And so, randomness. And so viruses are so interesting because viruses become in nature a opportunity for genetic change. Right. That, I think, is part of why viruses have existed for so long. There are, of course, viruses that specifically infect bacteria only, and they're called bacteriophages. Right. So there are bacteria targeted viruses, and then there are viruses that we know it can infect us. But what viruses do is they have genetic material, whether it's RNA and DNA or DNA, and it doesn't really matter. They kind of function very similarly. They need a host cell in order to replicate themselves, right? So they don't have any capability of multiplying by themselves, eating anything, metabolizing anything. They don't do any of that. They're just a little injection of DNA or RNA, and they need a cell to actually bind onto, inject that material, and take over the cell's machinery to make more copies of itself. One of the interesting things about viral genetics is that their genomes are very prone to errors. Right. There's not a lot of corrective mechanisms or proofreading mechanisms in the viral genome. And so what that allows for is it allows for continuous mutations, not only from the virus itself, but from the cell that's also infected. Right. So the idea is that the likelihood of where viruses came from is a way of cells transferring genetic material between one another. Right. Bacteria do this through something else called plasmids, where they have this little circular piece of DNA. It'll excrete it out into its environment and another cell can pick it up. And then now that cell has new capabilities, right? Because it has new codes. But in the biological world, we can look at viruses as being these reservoirs and transferers of genetic material and something that triggers that random mutation that is required for natural selection, right? So that's the big picture view of viruses. And what's so interesting is we are completely loaded with viruses, right? In our cerebral spinal fluid, we have all kinds of viruses. There's a whole group of researchers out of Johns Hopkins that's really mapping out the virome of your cerebral spinal fluid. And that's an area that we would be very nervous about because, wow, that's in our central nervous system and our brain and so on. And we're full of herpes simplex virus in there and papillomaviruses and all kinds of things sitting around in there, right? Most of us have long-term Epstein-Barr, cytomegalovirus infections in different parts of our neurons. And what we tend to find is an unevolved virus is one that tends to make you sick. But an evolved virus is supposed to be able to live with its host without actually killing or making the host sick, right? So that's the nature of viruses. Over time, what they're supposed to do is be able to live within a biological system that it needs to replicate its own self and so on, but not actually harm the host to the point that it kills the host off. And so viruses in general tend to move from being, very virulent and deadly to very benign and much more prevalent, right? So that's just the nature of viruses. So the vast majority of viruses that we encounter are pretty benign. We deal, our immune system deals with it very well. And, you know, in fact, some of them are, if they're evolved enough, can live within us forever, for the rest of our lives, without really causing too many problems, right? As long as the immune system is healthy and the microbiome is healthy. Because what we also see is latent viruses, so ones that exist within the system for long periods of time, they can start creating symptomatic issues if the microbiome and the immune system are compromised, right? Because now the balance and the control within this ecosystem that's full of viruses, bacteria, fungi, amoebas, and so on, the balances and the control mechanisms are not functioning properly. So any one organism, if it's allowed to proliferate too much, can start to cause symptomatic issues within individuals.
Well, coming to that point, there is a virus that's occupying us at the moment. do you have any insights on what the balance surrounding that virus in our microbiome contains?
Yeah. You know, what's interesting. So far there's at least four published studies on the relationship between your microbiome and your risk of hospitalization and death from this pandemic virus, right? And what is clear in those studies, these are in the four published studies, is that individuals that had the much higher risk of hospitalization and even mortality had very compromised microbiomes. They had lower diversity, lower levels of keystone species. These are species like Fecalum bacteria prausnitzii. These are very important anti-inflammatory, immune supportive species. And they tended to have higher levels of opportunistic organisms, right? Most of them had higher levels of Candida, for example, Candida albicans or Candida auris. So they had pathogenic or opportunistic organisms at higher prevalence. So a lot of the people that had high level or really poor immune response or hospitalization and death tend to have a dysfunctional microbiome. So then the question becomes, why is that, right? What is that molecular relationship between this dysfunctional microbiome or imbalanced microbiome and having a really poor response to this virus? The other part of that question is also, why is it that people with certain pre-existing conditions have a much worse response, right? So if you take diabetics, for example, or people with heart disease, now diabetics had the CDC data from last year showed 7 to 8 times higher likelihood of death from this virus compared to somebody same age who was not diabetic, right? So what is it about the diabetes that makes it so much, makes that person so much more vulnerable? The big question is it the diabetes itself? Is it the imbalance of blood sugars and the, you know, ill control of blood sugar? As it turns out, it's not. It's not the diabetes itself, the disease. It's not what's happening in the pancreatic cells. It's the conditions under which diabetes was allowed to develop. And those same conditions are the conditions that allow for immune dysfunction as well, right? So what are those conditions? Well, so publications from the American Diabetic Association and all of these big research institutes are very clear that the root cause of the development of type 2 diabetes is leaky gut. Right? Leaky gut, or as you may see it in some publications, they call it endotoxemia or intestinal barrier dysfunction. There's other fancier names because the name leaky gut kind of seems a little hokey, right? So, but you're seeing it in more research papers, but dysfunctions in the gut microbiome that lead to intestinal permeability, and that intestinal permeability leads to chronic low-grade inflammation. That becomes the condition under which many of these types of chronic illnesses develop, right? So diabetes, heart disease, and so on. Chronic low-grade inflammation coming from leakiness in the gut, and the leakiness in the gut is due to an imbalance of microbes in the microbiome, in the gut microbiome in particular. Now, why does an imbalance in microbes in the gut microbiome lead to leaky gut, right? That's an important question. Well, the reason is because the top layer of the intestinal lining is called a mucosal layer, and there's two distinct parts of the mucosal layer, the mucin 1 and mucin 2. The inner part of the mucosal layer, the mucin 2, is a relatively sterile part, meaning there's not a lot of microbes in that layer. In the top layer of the mucosa, that's where most of the microbes in your gut live. And so the microbes in your gut in the top layer, and then your intestinal cells down here, are communicating through this mucus layer all the time. And they're working together to protect the host. The immune system is getting signals from those gut microbes about what is in the environment, what's coming into the digestive system, and so on. So there's a good balance and crosstalk there. And it also keeps the immune cells down here from freaking out that there's a whole bunch of bacteria invading the system, right? This barrier, this physical barrier of the mucus layer is really critically important. What tends to happen if you have an imbalance, so let's say you take a course of antibiotics or you have poor eating habits for a while, or you eat foods that have lots of pesticides and herbicides and all that, what tends to happen is the beneficial bacteria whose job it is to maintain the structure of the mucosa, those beneficial bacteria levels go down, and then opportunistic bacteria levels start to go up. And what some of these opportunistic bacteria do is they eat away at that mucus layer. They can actually digest it for energy. So they start eating away at the mucus layer faster than the beneficial bacteria can help the body remake the mucus layer, right? So what happens over time is you get a net decrease in the mucus layer that makes all of the microbes in the microbiome move in closer to the intestinal lining. When it does that, and the intestinal lining, those cells that make up the intestinal lining, there is a number of immune cells in there. There's M cells and L cells and all that. When those cells detect that the microbes are all moving in much closer, they freak out because they think now that there's an invasion of microbes entering into the body, into circulation. So what they do is they start recruiting lots of immune cells to that area. And so now you've got constant inflammation in the lining of the gut, because that mucosal layer has been eaten away and most of the microbes and food particles and toxins from the outside world are continuously migrating very close to the intestinal lining cells. That constant inflammation in that area will kill off or damage the intestinal lining cells, leaving gaps in the space, right? And now when there's gaps in that space, toxins every day can just flow right through into circulation. And when that happens, you've got this inflammatory response that occurs all the time. So you've got this chronic low-grade inflammation happening in the body. That becomes the foundation of vast majority of chronic illnesses. Now, the other problem with chronic low-grade inflammation is it completely compromises immune response, right? And the reason for that is because, and we talked about earlier how the microbes are the ones that recruit the immune cells to different areas where infections happen, right? We took the lungs as an example, how when the lung microbes identify an influenza virus or any other virus that comes in, starts infecting the lungs, the microbes in the lungs send signals to the microbes in the gut. The microbes in the gut send signals to recruit immune cells to the lungs. All of these signals that the microbes use to activate the immune system are inflammatory signals, right? They're like little fire alarms that the microbes are setting off to try to attract the immune system. Now, if you have chronic low-grade inflammation from leaky gut, it means that you have fire alarms all over the body all the time. So it becomes very hard for the immune system to pay attention to the right thing. So somebody with a dysfunctional gut and leakiness in the gut, it will end up having diabetes, will end up having chronic illnesses, but that same leakiness and that same chronic inflammation is what allows a virus to come in, start infecting their lung cells, and it takes much longer for the immune system to even realize that that infection is happening, because the microbes may be signaling, but because of all the fire alarms all over the body, the immune cells take forever to get to that spot, which means the virus has much more time to replicate, and it create a bigger and bigger and bigger infection. And when the immune system finally shows up and sees it, the infection is big enough that the immune system goes really robust with inflammatory responses. And more often than not in these patients, it's the immune response that's damaging that organ and that tissue, right? So, and if it's happening in the lungs, that's what throws you into what we call the cytokine storm and then respiratory distress and so on. So that's the whole mechanism here.
And I mean, that's really crucial for people here to listen to, I think, because we have two aspects that you're talking. Once we have a decreased immune function, and then we have an increase in the potential for a cytokine storm. And in fact, interleukin 6, which is one of those inflammatory markers that you talked about, is a precursor for the degree of severity of COVID. And what should people do? Because it sounds to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that to control our gut is one of the key issues to basically come out well out of a COVID infection, as many other infections, by the way, as well. But what could people do preventatively? What should be fed to people in hospitals in the idea world? And I saw that you also had a product addressing leaky gut. So what is the concept that you would suggest?
And you know, I'm glad you brought up interleukin 6, because there's that big study called the Boston Dublin study, right, where they were looking at biomarkers in individuals that were predictive of how severe of a response you get to COVID. And the one thing that they saw was levels of interleukin 6. So if that inflammatory marker was high in your system, your risk of having a really bad response to COVID was quite high. And what is the biggest driver of chronic elevated interleukin 6? That's leaky gut, right? So when you look at all the leaky gut studies, all the endotoxemia, or however you want to label the condition, when you look at all of those intestinal permeability studies, the consequence is elevated interleukin 6. Right. And so it's all connected. So then the big question, yes, what can we do about it? You know, ultimately what we need to do is try to reestablish diversity within the microbiome, right? And also, if your gut is already imbalanced, if you have too much of opportunistic organisms, what you really need to get going is something to compete against those opportunistic organisms and bring their numbers back down, right? So thereby restoring some degree of balance back to the microbiome. Microbes do that really well, right? There's no better way to try to control certain microbes than with other microbes. Because when microbes do that, they do it very specifically, not like an atom bomb, like an antibiotic would do it, right? Which kills basically everything. And so what we've started focusing on is what kind of microbes provide that, the word we use is competitive exclusion, right? How do the microbes themselves, or what kinds of microbes can be used in order to go and look for problematic microbes and bring their levels down? That's where we came across the Bacillus endospores, because the Bacillus endospores since 1952 have been used as a prescription treatment for gut infections, right? Because these probiotic vector. Yeah. So Sanofi Aventis launched a product called Entro Germina, which is still in the market today. Still pretty widely used in many countries, which is a product that actually helps treat dysentery and other gut infections. And the reason for that is these probiotic spores have a certain level of intelligence where when you swallow them, they do something called quorum sensing, right? They read the microbial environment. And when they read the microbial environment, they can identify overgrown or problematic organisms. They'll actually go and sit next to them, and they'll produce compounds that bring down the growth of those organisms. And at the same time, they'll actually produce prebiotics and postbiotics that increase the growth of your beneficial bacteria. So they're like the orchestrator of the microbiome. And what's interesting is we don't really have a way of doing that ourselves, right? We don't have a mechanism in our body that when our microbes become imbalanced and we have too much opportunistic and not enough beneficial, we don't have a mechanism to correct that ourselves. We have outsourced that work to microbes to do that for us. And that makes sense over millions of years of evolution, right? Again, we have very limited genetic capability. So we have very few tools in our own chromosomes and our own genetic sequences. So what we've done is we've created this symbiotic relationship with microbes in the environment where we say, okay, we're going to give you a home by swallowing and eating you and so on and providing that space. But your job is to maintain that home and make sure that the home is healthy, right? So these microbes have developed intelligence over millions of years. So one of the critical things that people should be doing is ingesting these types of probiotic spores, because not only do they bring about the balance, they compete against the problematic organisms, they increase the good organisms, they increase diversity, but we've also shown in our publications that they seal up the gut lining, right? They reduce that leakiness in the gut, which is so important, because that leakiness in the gut drives that chronic low-grade inflammation, drives the atmosphere under which disease forms, and then it also drives immune dysfunction. And so that's important first step. Second step would be to improve the dietary diversity that you're taking in, right? So if you can increase the types of foods that you eat on a daily basis or a weekly basis, you can dramatically improve your overall diversity and bring down that leakiness in your gut and improve immunological function. So, you know, one of the things, the main things we can do to protect ourselves is beyond just taking the vitamin C's and zinc and D and all those things are important for immune health, but the foundation of immune health comes from the gut microbiome, right? And one of the things I always say is you cannot take enough vitamin C or zinc to overcome a dysfunctional microbiome and the impact that has on your immune response, right? So the key thing for people to focus on is maintaining diversity in the gut microbiome and reducing leakiness in the gut. And the simplest thing to do is the spore probiotics, the increase in diversity in food intake, and then another couple things they can do is some intermittent fasting. Fasting actually increases the diversity within the microbiome, which is counterintuitive, but it actually does. And fasting gives a chance for the gut lining to repair and so on. Stress management. Stress is one of the biggest drivers of the proliferation of opportunistic organisms. So when your body is under stress and there are all these opportunistic viruses and bacteria that can detect the level of stress hormones, and then they start proliferating when the host is under stress, right? So that can drive leaky gut and intestinal permeability and all that. So stress management becomes really important as well. And then, you know, the thing that we talked about earlier is getting outside. Getting outdoors. It makes such a big difference in the function of your immune system and your overall health is you have to get in the dirt somewhere, go out for a hike, right? Go out to the woods, go out to a lake, a beach if you're near the coast, whatever it may be, but get involved in nature, but be prescriptive about it. You know, assign yourself 30 minutes, three times a week to be outside in nature, right? Make it that important. Just like it's important to go to the gym or go for a walk, you know, for some exercise, it's important to be immersed in nature regularly throughout the day. So, you know, if in these hospitals where people are suffering from COVID, of course, if you're in there and you have to be on a respirator and all that, then it's modern medicine that has to help you, right? But if you are dealing with it and you're trying to improve your chances or support your system, you want to diversify your microbiome, you want to focus on what you're eating, you want to get outside if you can, you know, you want to manage stress while you're going through it. All of those things will help you before you ever get exposed, but it'll certainly help you if you ever get exposed as well.
Well, thank you very much for these words. And unfortunately, we're coming to your next meeting. I could be talking to you for ages, and I hope we'll have a second part of this.
Yeah, yes.
Because I think you're really fascinating. Just one more thing about it, because I'm very passionate about micronutrients, but especially about one class of micronutrients that we don't talk too much about. We talk about vitamins, we talk about minerals and all kinds of things, but phytochemicals. One of your talks, you said eating a good diversity basically means eating many different types of phytochemicals. Mm-hmm. And could you just, as a concluding explanation, say something about what actually is it that makes it so important to eat not just broccoli, but maybe eating a cucumber, a tomato, and something mm-hmm. else together? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, within those classes of foods, so within the classes of plant-based foods, and, you know, plants are amazing, amazing organisms, right? They're so diverse in their functionality and their structure, and what they produce metabolically and so on. And so what we get, what we benefit from those diversity in plant-based foods is we gain a lot of different carbohydrate structures, for one, that feed different types of organisms. And then number two, which acts as the prebiotic component of it. But then number two, there's a lot of chemistry in plants that we have, our microbes have developed capabilities of metabolizing to create compounds that are absolutely critical for our function, right? So one class that I love are polyphenols, for example. Polyphenols are so important to the diversity of your microbiome and eventually become really important to the function of your own cells that we cannot overstate the importance of getting adequate levels of polyphenols, right? So one, I'll give your audience one example of this. Polyphenols feed, in particular, one type of keystone species called Acromantia, right? So Acromantia mucinophila is a keystone organism in your large bowel. And when I say keystone, I mean it's labeled as a keystone organism because it's so important to not only the diversity and stability of the microbiome, but to the overall health of the host itself, right? So the host is dependent on high levels of this organism for a number of reasons. Acromantia in particular is inversely correlated with everything under the cardiometabolic spectrum, right? So if you have high levels of Acromantia, you are protected against diabetes, heart disease, polycystic ovarian syndrome, age-related dysfunction like Alzheimer's, you know, all of these obesity, all of these metabolic and cardiometabolic conditions. Acromantia at high levels protects against all of those conditions. And if you have low levels of Acromantia, your risk for those conditions go way up, right? So Acromantia loves fasting and Acromantia loves polyphenols. So getting polyphenols in becomes so important to increasing the growth of this one organism that protects you against about 60 different disorders, right? And then just to dig into that a little bit deeper, polyphenols are also converted in the gut into other compounds that we cannot extract from food, compounds like urolithins, right? Mm-hmm. Urolithin A is a very, very important compound for our function and existence, and we don't get that from food, and we don't produce it ourselves. It has to come from polyphenols being metabolized in the gut by microbes, converting the polyphenol into this compound urolithin A. So what does this compound urolithin A do? Well, it's one of the critical compounds in maintaining mitochondrial function in our cells, right? All our cells have these little engines in them called mitochondria. And when these engines stop functioning or reduce their function, that becomes the definition of aging, right? Aging is really defined by the mitochondrial dysfunction. There's something called the mitochondrial free radical theory of aging that really talks through at the cellular level how aging is driven by mitochondrial damage. Each of your cells have these engines, but when those engines get damaged over time, your cells can no longer produce adequate energy, and that means the cells will start to die, which means that the tissues that the cells make up start to degenerate and die. And that happens all throughout your body, your heart, your circulation, your brain, your skin, everything. All of these cells have mitochondria. The ability to turn over the mitochondria, meaning removing damaged mitochondria and bringing in new healthy mitochondria, is a process called mitophagy. That mitophagy process is driven by this compound urolithin A, right? So without adequate urolithin A, we won't convert and create enough effective mitochondria. And over time, our mitochondria start to die and we age faster, right? So, and this compound, again, you can only get it from polyphenols from plant sources being converted in the gut by microbes into urolithins. And that's how important that connection is, right? So think about this compound, urolithin A, that is so critically important for our cellular function. We can't make it ourselves. We can't absorb it from food. We need our microbes to take polyphenols, convert them, and create it for us, right? So we cannot overstate the importance of that diversification in your diet, getting as many plant-based foods in there, getting these phytochemicals into your system, because we've evolved to function by taking advantage of the capabilities of our microbes and their ability to metabolize plants and convert plant-based chemicals into other compounds that we really require.
Well, thank you very much for these concluding remarks about the the expensive health interventions that you talked about, take time in nature, book a new diary, eat berries and grapes, and live longer, take care of your mitochondria, decrease inflammation. Kieran, thanks so much for all your wonderful wisdom, and I hope it will inspire all our listeners as it did me, and hopefully we'll see you soon again.
Yeah, look forward to it. Thank you.
All the best, Kieran.
Bye-bye.
Bye.